Welcome to EncLive On Air. I'm your host today, Jessica Hergert. EncLive On Air is a podcast from EncLive, which provides oncology professionals with the resources and information they need to provide the best patient care. In both digital and print formats, EncLive covers every angle of oncology practice, from new technology to treatment advances to important regulatory decisions. In today's episode, we had the pleasure of speaking with David Huntsman, MD, FRCPC, FCCMG, the Dr. Chu Wei Memorial Professor of Gynecologic Oncology, Canada Research Chair in Molecular and Genomic Pathology, Professor in the Departments of Pathology and Laboratory Medicines and Obstetrics and Gynecology at the University of British Columbia, co-founder and director of OVCare, and Chief Medical Officer of Connexia Health, to discuss the growth of precision medicine across oncology. In our exclusive interview, Huntsman discussed the elements of precision medicine that have contributed to its growth in the field of oncology, some of the setbacks regarding its integration, and areas of research that have the potential to propel precision medicine to the next tier of scientific discovery and application. Thank you so much, Dr. Huntsman, for taking the time out of your, I'm sure, very busy schedule to meet with me. It's much appreciated. So we are here today to talk essentially about precision medicine and the field of oncology. So as a field, oncology really has been moving toward implementing aspects of precision medicine, it seems, wherever possible. So what have some of the drivers of this shift really been in oncology?
In the management of cancers, the generic approaches to with histologic-based cancer treatments essentially capped out. To further improve cancer care, there was a need to refine the treatment and to identify within any histologically defined type of cancer patients who would respond for different therapies. Much of this had been based on targeting cancers with specific mutations. And around 10 years ago, next generation sequencing started to be used to identify the mutations in cancer using unbiased approaches, which has led to a plethora of opportunities to have a more precise approach to treating cancers, which with some treatment targets transcending histologic subtypes and some being confined within. You know, it sounds very exciting, but I must admit, if somebody told me today that not all patients get access to the cancer testing they need, even the most simple tests, to better direct their care, at this point in time, I wouldn't have believed it 10 years ago. I would have thought we would have, in terms of implementation, been considerably further ahead than we are. That statement would hold true in Canada as well as the United States. And in particular, there was an assumption when the Human Genome Project was finished that we were rapidly going to transform into a completely different whole genome-driven cancer care system. And this obviously hasn't happened except in very specific research programs. So the implementation has been a little bit slower than one would have anticipated, but the move towards stratification and then ultimately more personalized cancer treatments is sort of unwavering, but hasn't progressed with the alacrity which one would have expected.
How is molecular profiling contributing to this shift, and where has the greatest impact been in gynecologic cancers in particular?
I study in my research program gynecologic and in particular ovarian cancers, and everything we see there probably, there are versions of the same in other cancer groups, so I think it's quite instructive. What we've seen is in some of the rarer subtypes of gynecologic cancer, there are now very specific genomic-based diagnostics. These are often pathognomonic mutations, meaning that the disease state is defined by the genomic feature. What this means is that the diagnostic can often become the indication for therapy. And because these tumors are very rare, it's unlikely you're going to have a diversity of treatments within that cancer type because they'd just be too rare to ever test that. So examples where we are rapidly moving into new treatment opportunities would include the discovery of SMARCA4 mutations, which define small cell hypercalcemic ovarian cancers, And because there are good cell lines to study, we've gone from not understanding this cancer at all to having several really interesting treatment opportunities which need testing in trials, but a global community which can probably only run one trial at a time because it's a rare cancer. In other cancers, such as granulosa cell tumor of the ovary, where we discovered this mutation in a gene called FOXL2, which defines the cancer, because there aren't good models to study, we don't have a biologically informed treatment strategy, which has arisen from redefining the tumor. And so once you find the mutation, if you don't have model systems to work with, it can be a painfully slow process to turn that into anything other than a diagnostic. In the more common cancers, for instance, in endometrial cancer, the Cancer Genome Atlas Project has provided a genomic-based classification system, which appears in the kind of reduced-to-practice type manifestations to be both useful and, you know, reproducible. This is going to change the way, I believe, all uterine carcinomas are managed, because the histologic-based classification just didn't really work, with there being incredibly poor reproducibility in histologic classification. The molecular classification, where these cancers are broken into polymutated, which have a fantastic prognosis for reasons we don't quite understand, MSI positive, which may respond to immune modulation therapy, copy number high, which may in some cases respond to classic cytotoxic therapy, but we need new treatments, and copy number low cases, which are usually Wnt pathway driven, usually have an indolent course, but sometimes can be really difficult to treat, and for reasons we don't understand, has provided a framework for us to move forward in this cancer type, both in more basic and translational research, but also in clinical trials. So that's been an immense change. There's now the stratified approach to the consideration and care of uterine cancers. In ovarian carcinomas, pathology works, and so we didn't need to have a molecular tool to tell us what subtype of cancer we're dealing with. What we needed are better insights into the nature of each of the subtypes and whether in the more common subtypes there's capacity to further stratify care. So in high-grade serous carcinoma of the ovary, there is a molecular classification of that disease, but it doesn't at this point in time have a clinical function. Strangely, the expression-based classification of that disease doesn't correlate particularly well with the really meaningful features in this cancer, such as the presence of BRCA1 and 2 or other homologous recombination associated mutations. Those mutations obviously indicate patients who may both respond better to platinum taxane, but more importantly, respond to PARP inhibitors. In the non-HRD associated cancers, some of them have cyclin E amplification. These appear to have a worse prognosis. They're genomically somewhat distinct. And there are clinical trials focused on this subgroup, but no treatment which has emerged as a ready for prime time. Although in high-grade serous cancer of the ovary, the move towards more stratified approaches appears to have been led by PARP inhibitors, the trials of niraparib suggest that we're not as far ahead as we would like to be in terms of identifying patients who should benefit the most from PARP inhibitors. So we know that patients with BRCA mutations or whose genomes have an HRD signature should respond, and they appear to respond. But there's also a response in patients who have neither of those features, and that is not understood. And so our ability to stratify patients for treatment sometimes falls behind the actual treatment opportunities, and this would be such a case. Whether we will end up with just a histologic-based approach to treating that cancer, which has been proposed, and then we sort out who should continue therapy based on response, or whether we can find a better marker of non-response to PARP inhibitor is yet to be seen. And so in each of the types of ovarian or other gynecologic cancer, there are some specific examples of how treatment is becoming more personalized and also the barriers which have been met. The clear cell cancer of the ovary, a cancer which is second most common type of ovarian cancer, and it doesn't tend to respond to platinum and taxane, the standard therapy. we don't really have a proven way forward. We know that we need new treatments. There's considerable research going on internationally, and in particular trying to determine whether common mutations in ARID1A, which is part of the chromatin remodeling switch NF complex, may offer some kind of way forward. But there's nothing ready for prime time at this point.
What barriers have sort of prevented the adoption of genomic approaches to cancer research and cancer care?
Although starting with sort of more genetic approaches and now more genomic approaches to looking at tumors have been around for quite a while, the majority of the pathology community is not able to deliver the data which patients need from these approaches. So it's led to a very disjointed implementation. Whereas when I did my pathology training and trained afterwards to become a molecular pathologist, I would have assumed by this point in time that it would just be deeply embedded within and just be considered an inextricably linked and important part of pathology itself. It still sits somewhat on the outside, which I don't think really helps anyone. We, in terms of Connexia Health, and I know other groups have been working to try to simplify the molecular diagnostics that patients need so they can be easily embedded within pathology departments and be offered in a less kind of disjointed kind of fashion to improve patient decisions. In addition to there being rather slow uptake and implementation within pathology departments and labs, there are some biologic and technical hurdles which need to be dealt with. So we know that if you take a single small sampling of a tumor, it probably has the early mutations in that cancer represented, but cancers can be very heterogeneous and it may not have all the mutations you want to look at. Also, some cancers are difficult to biopsy, and it's hard to get enough biomaterials from the tumor themselves to do all the analysis you need. So this has led to a move away from one test at a time type approaches, which can exhaust tissue samples, to NGS samples, but also a consideration of cell-free DNA testing as an adjunct to tissue-based testing, because it may provide a broader view of what's going on in their tumor, in particular if resistance mutations to targeted therapies are starting to emerge. The heterogeneity of tumors across space and time are a concern which single samplings of tumors done at one time point really won't address. So we need to have, if we're going to have effective precision oncology, we do need to move beyond that.
Of course, the COVID-19 pandemic is on everybody's minds even now. What impact has the COVID-19 pandemic really had on cancer care? And can precision oncology approaches help to overcome some of these challenges?
The numbers are now starting to come in terms of how badly COVID-19 has hit already taxed cancer care and control systems. And it's quite grim. I mean, in most jurisdictions, there was already a struggle to provide timely diagnostics for cancer patients and also definitive surgeries in some places, because there was already a challenge having several months where these processes were essentially ceased has created terrible issues for patients. And whereas before the barriers to cancer care were more kind of geographic and economic, they have become global. The one kind of ray of hope where I think some of the new tools of precision oncology can really help would be the use of cell-free DNA as a tool to identify treatment opportunities in patients with relapsed and metastatic cancers. And although this was emerging through many research studies as a viable option, probably not a complete replacement for tissue-based biopsy, but a good first pass on whether you can identify a treatment approach while you're waiting for a definitive diagnosis and or surgery, COVID-19 has really sort of shone a light on this, because of course, if you can identify in a patient's home community from a single blood test how that cancer should be treated based on a clinical suspicion of relapse or metastatic cancer and a cell-free DNA test, that patient won't have to get exposed to a high-risk environment by going in for a more invasive biopsy, and the much-needed healthcare resources won't have to be deployed for that patient to do the biopsy. And this approach will not find a treatment solution to more patients, but even in some modest number, like 50% of patients, that would be a tremendous benefit to the healthcare systems and the patients themselves. So cell-free DNA-based diagnostics were going to become an important part of cancer control, but COVID has accelerated that. Again, it will not replace the need for biopsies, but what it does is circumvent the rush to get these tissue-based diagnostics. And there have been many great studies which have shown that cell-free DNA diagnostics will identify features of importance not found in a single biopsy due to intratumoral heterogeneity. But also there are some features which you'll find in the biopsy which were lost in the weeds in the cell-free DNA and won't be found. So these do complement each other, but as a first pass, this is an incredibly powerful approach to find ways of helping patients without exposing them to COVID-19 risk.
What would you say are some of the challenges regarding precision medicine that future research efforts should really address going forward?
Although total cost of cancer control has been a major concern in publicly funded healthcare systems, in America, financial toxicity is now becoming a real concern. And of course, there always have been a lot of people concerned about it. But I think in the broadest possible sense, this is now viewed as a major issue. And so precision medicine approaches cannot be divorced from the need to improve the cost effectiveness of care. I think that the pandemic, which has, of course, been an equal opportunity healthcare problem because everybody's at risk, has really kind of shone a light on how we're kind of all in this together in terms of healthcare, and we need cost-effective solutions if we're going to manage important problems such as cancer effectively across populations. And I believe, again, cell-free diagnostics do offer some real hope there. It becomes even more important that, if there are expensive new treatments, which may offer fantastic opportunities for patients, but we really find out who's going to benefit and who's not. The need to identify which high-grade serous carcinoma of the ovary patients will not respond to some of the newer PARP inhibitors becomes really important as an example. Another example would be, we know there are some patients who have fantastic responses to immune modulation therapy, and ex-president Carter is probably a fantastic poster child for that because he was close to passing away and now is still active. We know there are lots of patients with similar features in their tumors who don't respond, and better tools to identify who will respond to that powerful range of therapies are needed if we'll be able to afford them as a society.
So looking to the future, are there any exciting developments in the pipeline or on the horizon regarding precision medicine that you think are really exciting and important to highlight?
I think, and again, this would be when you address a question like this and you're asked to step back and look at something and predict the future, almost inevitably you're going to be wrong. But giving it a shot, I'm really excited by cell-free DNA-based diagnostics because I view them as the equivalent to a mobile phone as compared to landlines. And so cancer care to this point has been driven by surgical oncology mainly. And surgeons could offer cures, oncologists palliated. If the ability to make effective diagnosis and treatment decisions in a non-surgical approach is matched to more powerful treatments the whole paradigm for cancer care could change in a way which would dissolve geographic barriers to access. And so if you think of how cell phones started off in the West as a luxury item, and now we use them the whole time, but often people have landlines as well. In places without landlines, they just adopted them and they became everything. So I think with cancer becoming a huge burden around the world, and particularly in more developing economies, cell-free DNA diagnostics offers some sort of vista for how we could move to a non-surgical approach to cancer care. Now, of course, debulking is absolutely essential right now for many tumors, but there may be cancer types where the treatment becomes effective enough that it can become non-surgical, which would be, you know, extraordinarily exciting transition to watch and as a researcher and clinician to be part of.
Is there anything else regarding this topic that I didn't ask you but you think is important for listeners to know?
The next generation sequencing of cancers yielded a lot of really interesting diagnostic features and as well as potential treatment targets. And we've learned a lot from this. A lot of cancers have mutations in chromatin remodeling complexes, such as the switch-NF complex. And these mutations are going to be difficult to target because the switch-NF complex and other chromatin remodeling complexes have a very important role in defining cell context, and therefore the treatment approaches are going to be cell context specific. And so we're less likely to have cancer treatment approaches which transcend histologies or cell context for those kinds of mutations. And this has been shown not just in that field, but also in targeting BRAF mutations and many other types of common cancer mutations. An exception would be the oncogenic gene fusions, which are so aberrant that the targeting of them really does seem to transcend histotype in a really interesting way, in that you have a small percentage of all of the common cancers have these targetable oncogenic gene fusions. So it makes the implementation of a screen for these fusions really important, but it has to be cost effective and it has to look for all the gene fusions, because some of them are very rare in any particular cancer type. But if you find one, it can be a tremendous opportunity for a patient because the treatments can be stunningly effective. And so not all the mutations which we're finding are equal in terms of the treatment opportunities they're going to present. And the implementation of these will be very specific based on the types of mutations which are found.
That's all we have for today. Thank you for listening to this episode of OncLive On Air. Check back on Mondays and Thursdays for exclusive interviews with leading experts in the oncology field and recaps from our State of the Science summits and Institutional Perspectives in Cancer webinars. For more updates on oncology, be sure to visit www.onclive.com and sign up for our e-newsletters. OncLive is also on social media. On Twitter, follow us at OncLive and OncLiveSOSS. On Facebook, like us at OncLive and OncLive State of the Science Summit, and follow our OncLive page on LinkedIn. If you liked today's episode of OncLive On Air, please consider subscribing to our podcast on Apple Podcasts or Spotify so you get a notification every time a new episode is posted. While you are there, please take a moment to rate us. Thanks again for listening to OncLive On Air.